Good afternoon, Your Honors. It is a privilege to be here today. I speak on behalf of the plaintiffs below appellants in this case and the class of limited partners of the former CENCOM Cable Income Fund Limited Partnership. The issue before us today is a fairly discrete issue. There were many other issues in this case, of course, that we are not discussing today. I think it important and a good introduction to the merits to start with the standard of review in this case. The appellants have argued that this is a de novo review, and the appellees disagree. I would like to direct your attention to the opinion below on page 18 of the slip opinion, the paragraph beginning, two principal reasons coalesce and call for the rejection of the plaintiff's claim to quarterly distribution payments in addition to the interest payments that they did receive. And the court goes on to make his decision based entirely upon an analysis of A, the partnership agreement, and B, the disclosure statement. So although the court said that he had waited until presiding over a full trial in order to finally determine this issue, having previously declined to do it on summary judgment, he nevertheless actually made his decision based on these two documents. And what we are therefore talking about is the meaning of two agreements, the partnership agreement and the disclosure statement, which is nothing more than a consent solicitation to which the limited partners were asked to agree, with two agreements. And the question here is whether the second agreement, the consent solicitation agreement, overrides the explicit terms of the limited partnership agreement pursuant to which this entity was formed. Now, there is one key paragraph that
so
both
fact finding is irrelevant in that context then?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's at stake here, I gather, is whether what occurred had to be approved by 100% of the limited partners or whether it could be approved as it in fact was by a majority?
That's part of what's at stake here.
What's the rest of it?
Well, the rest of it is whether the limited partners had any information that they were sacrificing their contractual rights.
Okay, whether their vote was informed.
Right, that's part of it. And also, it's not just whether or not 58% is enough or 100% is enough. It's also a question as to whether the general partner followed the specific provisions of the partnership agreement. It's not just the percentage, there's a process.
Okay, that has that's a lot of issues. Could you order them in a logical way so that we'll know where you're going?
Yes, Your Honor. The partnership agreement gives the limited partners a right to an 11% preferred distribution. And there's nothing in the agreement, as all the judges who've looked at this so far, both of the judges that have looked at it so far have determined, there's nothing in the agreement that provides for the cessation of the operating distributions prior to the termination of the partnership. And pursuant to the partnership agreement, so that's number one, you have the right to distributions. Number two, you have a very specific process for amendment contained in Section 10 of the partnership
agreement.
You're
saying the partnership agreement had to be amended, that there was going to be any alteration in that that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the partnership agreement also provides that when you prejudice the limited partner's right to distributions, you need consent of each affected limited partner. So those
without an amendment, you would need 100% approval.
You would need everybody's consent. And you can't treat them differently because they're all entitled to be treated the same. So in order to accomplish these things, that these meaning the cessation of the distributions, the general partner here looked to the disclosure statement in the consent solicitation materials. And there was one key paragraph in it. It's in the appendix, page 153 of the appendix. And this is the only paragraph, I believe, that contains both the notion that distributions will cease and that the and the other notion that the limited partners will receive a 5.25% per annum interest on the purchase price. And both of the appellees here in the court conflated the two as a trade-off. But let's see exactly what the document in question says. Again, on page 153 in the large paragraph, introduces with a sentence, the approval by the limited partners of the sale transaction will include the limited partners' agreement and approval that, notwithstanding the consummation date, the sale will be deemed to have been effected as of July 1, 1995. Accordingly, from and after July 1, 1995, the systems will be operated for the account of the purchasing affiliates, rather than the partnership, and no further quarterly distributions will be made in respect to the LP units. And it continues.
And is that something that you claim is not clear?
What is not clear is that the limited partners had a contractual right to these distributions. It's not clear at all. It simply refers to a statement of fact. As a result of this transaction, you will no longer receive distributions.
Is it your position that your client's entitled to the distributions and the interest, both?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's the rationale for that?
The general partner and its purchasing affiliates proposed this transaction, and part and parcel of that transaction was that they were going to pay 5.25% on the purchase price after a certain date. Now, when one invests in an asset such as this, an interest in these income-producing properties, one might expect distributions, one expects appreciation. One expects both things to result from the investment. There was a particular time frame in this transaction.
Well, I know it was the next year, and then it moved to March. And as I understand the court's opinion, it was basically that you were entitled to the distributions until the termination, which is your point, that you had to give us the distributions until the termination, and you stopped. And because you deemed it to have been done, you know, the summer before. But the question is, since the deal that you disagree with was predicated on the distribution stopping and interest starting, what the Vice Chancellor said at the end of the day is he looked at the amount of money you would have gotten in distributions versus the amount of money that you got, and he concluded that even if you're right and you needed 100% vote, there was no damage because the aggregate amount of money you got at the end of the day was greater than you would have gotten in distributions. So what was erroneous about that?
Well, what's erroneous, and this is a key to what the court said, because the court below actually used the words instead, that instead of the distributions, you're getting the interest. This paragraph does not say instead. It says there are two consequences of the way that we've structured this transaction. It doesn't say that in exchange, and there's no such language in here. It doesn't say that in exchange for this, you are, in exchange for this interest, you are sacrificing your distribution. It doesn't say that at all.
Can I approach this perhaps from a different perspective? First of all, are we all in agreement that the Vice Chancellor's statement is accurate as a matter of fact, that what you received as interest payments is more than what you would have received as distributions?
It's about the same amount. It's slightly more.
It's not less than.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
If the agreement provided that the transaction will close on whatever future date, and until that date, you will get your distributions. That's it. No interest. You will get your distributions. Would that be valid?
Sure.
And so you're taking the position that because the agreement called for interest but no distributions, and because the agreement couldn't stop the distributions as it purported to do, now you get both, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is there some way you explain to me why that's not a windfall?
Well, it's not a windfall because these were rapidly appreciating assets. We had other claims in here. For example, Your Honor, there was a claim that was dismissed as part of the claims dismissed via summary judgment by then Vice Chancellor Steele that stated that these appraisals were stale and these were rapidly appreciating assets and they should have done something to update the appraisals.
But how is that at all responsive to the question you were asked? I mean, I thought your position was that the right to a distribution is enshrined in the partnership agreement. If there is going to be any abridgment of the right to a distribution, it can only come about through an amendment to the partnership agreement, which would require 100% approval by the limited partners.
Yes, Your Honor.
That it cannot be accomplished by a merger or acquisition agreement that's approved by 58% of the partners.
Correct, Your Honor.
If that's right, then the only consequence that would follow from that is that this transaction, leaves you only with the distribution. Otherwise, the transaction has no validity, at least in terms of the consideration that's being paid.
Well, Your Honor, I was making the comment that I was about the staleness of the appraisals to illustrate a point, and that the limited partners were not able to make that claim because the partnership agreement was strictly construed, and therefore the limited partners were deemed to have bought into an appraisal process, and the partnership agreement didn't say when the time frame the appraisals must be accomplished within.
I still don't understand how that responds to the question that was asked basically on a conceptual level.
What I'm saying is that the general partners and their affiliates ought to be held to the same standard here. The disclosure statement did not say that this deal is contingent upon every provision of the described transaction being effectuated. It says, we are asking for your approval of this package. And the limited partners, by a majority vote, approved the package. But what I'm further saying is that the general partners put something into this package that was prohibited by the partnership agreement, and they did so at their peril, at their risk, that they would have to pay both the interest and cause the partnership to continue to pay the distributions. You can't.
Doesn't that put the rabbit in the hat? Because if your argument is right, it necessarily follows that the economic consequences if you keep your distribution, and there cannot be a substitution thereby of interest.
Your Honor, there is nothing in here that states that we are only paying the interest if we're allowed to terminate your distributions. These were two separate acts. One was improperly accomplished, and only that part of the transaction, not the entire transaction.
Actually, it may not have said that in so many words, but that was the import, wasn't it? That distributions will cease as of July or whatever the day was, and from that point on there will be interest. I mean, that's pretty clear.
Well, Your Honor, what it says is that A, distributions will cease, and B, there will be interest. It could have said distributions will continue under the requirements of the partnership agreement, and we will pay interest.
They could have, but they didn't.
That's right. But in effect, they did, because the attempt to get limited partner approval of the termination of the distributions was not done pursuant to the constraints of the partnership agreement.
All right. That substitution of interest for distribution could have been accomplished under your theory only if 100% of the limited partners voted consistent with the disclosure statement and agreement, correct?
Agreed, Your Honor.
And they did not. That's no. There's no factual dispute about that.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm still waiting to find out why you do have damages if the court were to agree with the trial court to the effect of, right, you may be correct that you were entitled to have the distributions under the agreement and that the agreement couldn't be modified by less than 100% vote. So you win that one. Now we look to what you actually got, and what you actually got was a little bit more than what the distributions would have been. And at least the plan was that these would be substituted payments, so we will now call those distributions instead of interest, and everything's fine.
But Your Honor, they did not call them distributions instead of interest, and they're really entirely separate things. The distributions come from the operation of the cable systems. The interest is money that's a sense of a bookkeeping entry on money that's sitting in a bank account that was in the possession of the purchasing affiliates. It was never in the possession of the partnership. They're qualitatively different things. Now, the defendants may have wanted it to come out that way, but to do so, they have to follow the requirements of the partnership agreement.
But what I'm trying to get at is, let's assume hypothetically.
Yes, Your Honor.
That they had followed everything correctly, and therefore the agreement didn't say you will get no distributions, you'll get interest. The agreement said you'll get distributions until the day that we actually terminate the partnership. If that was the way it was put, how would that leave you injured, harmed?
If the consent solicitation said that you'll continue to get distributions pursuant to the partnership agreement,
but no interest, mm-hmm.
and the limited partners consented to that, then there would be no harm. But that's not what happened. The hypothetical is distinguishable.
But the limited partners agreed to something that sounded like exactly that.
It sounds a lot like it to sophisticated attorneys and jurists, but it's not the same thing. The limited partners, in order to waive their contractual rights, have to have voluntarily and intentionally relinquished those rights with knowledge of all of the material facts. And it's certainly a material fact here that the partnership agreement directly prohibited what the general partner was trying to do.
But didn't your one witness say, yeah, he understood that this is what's going on, that it was a substitution?
He said that he understood that the effect of the transaction was to terminate his distributions. But he did not understand that there was a contractual right to those distributions that was being concealed by the general partner's failure to discuss it in the disclosure statement. And therefore, his although he didn't consent, his understanding, like those of the other limited partners, was based on an incomplete set of material facts that were before them in this consent solicitation statement.
Did the vice chancellor find that there was no breach of the contract? Did he find that there was no breach of fiduciary duty? And was the issue of fiduciary duty even raised? Or was this strictly a contract argument?
Well, Your Honor, we also, he decided the issue in the context in which we have been discussing it as a contract issue. But we also alleged a claim below and claim here that the same conduct constituted a breach of the duty that was assumed to itself by the general partner to ensure that the special counsel to the limited partners, the hush firm, made sure that there was compliance with the partnership agreement.
That's the fairness agreement. The
right.
Fairness.
The implied fairness obligation that the general partner took on in order to induce the limited partners to agree to this.
Well, be that as it may, whether we talk about this in terms of you know, damages resulting from a breach of contract or you know, recovery as a result of the transaction being unfair, there is no unfair price or damages unless we agree with you that the limited partners are entitled both to the distribution and to the interest that was promised in this deal. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, of course, Your Honor. Okay, I mean, so we originally had claims for damages right. many times this
year. If they're only entitled to one or the other, there's no damage and no unfairness.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that would still
That's
be unfair.
That's a yes or a no?
Yeah. I would argue that it was unfair, but I would lose because that would be your conclusion.
All right. So the real issue here is a matter whether, as a matter of law, in these circumstances, the limited partners were entitled not only to their distribution, because only an amendment to the partnership agreement could divest them of it, and also to the interest. Correct?
Well, Your Honor, I would amend that slightly. I would say in all circumstances, the limited partners had a right to the interest because that was...
No, I'm asking whether that's a fair statement of the issue.
Yes, Your Honor, it's fair.
Okay, so we would have to find that there is a legal entitlement to both.
Yes.
Okay. I think we've already been over the territory, at least the basis of your claim of a legal entitlement to the distribution. I'm still not sure where you get a legal entitlement, if you're right on the first count, to the interest. I mean, there's a kind of gotcha quality about it, isn't there?
Well, no, Your Honor. It's certainly not the way that...
Well, you promised that you would give us interest. We're going to hold you to that promise, but you did it wrong. You know, you didn't get an agreement of the other 42% of the stockholders, so you've got to pay the distribution too.
Your Honor, it is the general partner's job here to do it the right way. And you can call it gotcha, but I call it the general partner trying to gloss over the terms of the partnership agreement for the sake of its own expediencies, for the sake of its own deal-making, for the sake of its own sales job in getting this approved. So I don't see it as a gotcha type thing. I call it holding the general partner to the same strict compliance with the partnership agreement that the general partner used against the limited partners to enable it to buy these properties without any independent search for value or oversight.
But the Court of Chancery concluded that a reasonable limited partner would have understood that Hush had undertaken an effort to assure that the limited partners received that to which they contracted for through the partnership agreement. What's wrong with that finding?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that Hush did not do that. Hush did not even apparently address or consider the issue of whether it was permissible under the partnership agreement to terminate the distributions.
You have 8 seconds left for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I waive my 8 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel for the appellants. What your honors have been talking about this afternoon is exactly what has been an issue at this case, in this case, for more than 12 years, almost since it was filed, and that is the issue of whether the termination of so-called distributions, one that can be resolved as a matter of contract interpretation, or is it a matter that requires a review of evidence and a review of the facts? And that's an issue that has been addressed by the Chancery Courts that have had the issue before them since 1997. And by my count, the Chancery Court 5 times had opportunities through motions for summary judgment and cross motions for summary judgment to have determined the issue of whether the distributions were a breach of the partnership agreement, and 5 times the Chancery Court determined, in response to requests by the parties, that no, it could not be determined as a simple matter of contract interpretation, but that it required a review of the law and a review of the facts against the law, and particularly as to what the limited partners would have understood when they approved the transaction. John.
Well, before we get to that, I mean, the core argument made by your honorable opponent is that there was an absolute right under the partnership agreement to receive these distributions through the life of the partnership, absent an amendment that would have required 100% approval. The question is that right defeasible? Where only a majority, but less than 100% of the partners agree to an acquisition transaction that's otherwise permitted supposedly under the agreement and the statute. That is to say, what is the legal basis for defeasing what would otherwise be a right that could only be voluntarily relinquished by 100%?
Your Honor, through the years and in various submissions to the Chancery Court, we presented a number of reasons why it would be appropriate and consistent with the partnership agreement to structure the sale transaction as it was, that is, to substitute interest for distributions. I can go through a recap of all those positions if it would help the court.
Your top two.
The top two out of 7 would be that the limited partners, because it was a closed-end investment, and under the closed-end investment and under the term or for the term of the partnership agreement, had no expectation that they would be receiving a payout after dissolution and during the wind-up phase.
But the argument on the other side, and just let me stop you and go to your second point, is that this was an announcement. From now on, you're going to get interest, but you're not getting any more distributions. 58% said okay, and 42% said, fine, you can pay me interest, but you still have to pay me distributions. That's not a unilateral decision for you to make.
And, Your Honor, that is the issue that had remained alive all the way through trial, and that's the issue that in the final analysis, and some of this court has addressed this in discussions with counsel for the appellants, the bottom line is, and as Vice Chancellor Noble found, that even if the terms of the partnership agreement were transgressed, and that was the term that Vice Chancellor Noble used, there was no injury to the limited partners, and that is a point that we have been making over the years and in various submissions to the court.
And we understand that. I mean, the question I'm asking is really technical. That is there authority in the partnership agreement and the statute to do what was done here by a shareholder approval that was short of unanimous?
I think, Your Honor, that among other things, an interpretation of the provisions of the partnership agreement that would require an amendment, which in turn would require a 100% vote, are subject to disagreement. I don't think that there has ever been any opinion that has squarely head-on responded to the argument that the issue of amendment and consent can be construed directly from the agreement.
But that doesn't respond to the question that I asked, which is, you know, where is the source of the authority in the agreement and the statute, if relevant, to accomplish what was done here by, you know, by a procedure that was other than a formal 100% amendment, 100% approved amendment of the partnership agreement. Surely, when the you know, general partner was advised that it could proceed in that way, there had to be some legal basis for that. Unless, of course, nobody was thinking about the distribution issue.
Your Honor, I certainly have to presume there were a number of lawyers advising the general partner and the purchasers on this, that the issue was addressed and it was regarded as within the authority of the general partner under a broad grant of authority in the partnership agreement to structure a sales transaction in the best interests of wind-up and termination. And it was within that, and that is how the issue was originally framed, and that is the sale transaction, one incident of which was to substitute interest for distributions within the authority of the partner, general partner in the partnership agreement.
And so the statutory and the contractual authority of the general partner to propose a winding up and dissolution is a procedure that has independent significance, a significance independent of the quite different procedure to amend the partnership agreement.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I don't believe that under the partnership agreement itself that it is at all clear that this would have required an amendment, which would have in turn required 100% of the vote. That is an issue that over the years has, I think, kind of been lost in the debate back and forth. But the issue of substitution of interest for distributions was just a small incident of the overall transaction that was structured and presented to the limited partners for a vote. Again, the issue of what the limited partners understood, the consequence of approving the transaction, has been absolutely a live issue in the context of the distribution dispute for almost 15 years.
Well, and let's go back for a moment to what you said earlier about the vice chancellor's finding. Typical of a judge in equity, he used a word I don't understand, almost biblical. The general partner transgressed the contract. Now, let's assume he meant breached the contract. Isn't that a finding that you had to have 100% of the limited partners to agree to, as Justice Jacobs referred to it, defease their right to distributions? Otherwise, you breached the contract? But there's no consequence, he finds, because at the end of the day, interest is a substitute for any harm that you may have suffered. So it's, again, inequity. Forget about the contract's significance. It's a wash. Isn't that basically that after 12 years, the ultimate decision is you breached the contract, but there are no damages that aren't outweighed by another form of payment, so you have nothing to recover at the end of the day. Isn't it that simple?
It's almost that simple.
I knew there was a catch.
I don't believe that Vice Chancellor Noble squarely and 100% nailed down the question of whether this was a breach. What Vice Chancellor Noble addressed and what Your Honor many years ago in confronting the same issue addressed was I can't decide this issue without reference to what a reasonably prudent limited partner would have understood in approving the transaction. The issue of understanding and consent, and that is why this is not a case, with respect to my opponent, that can be decided de novo and be decided without reference to the record and without reference to Vice Chancellor Noble's opinion and findings, which he explicitly noted were made with the benefit of the complete trial record before it, with the court acting as fact finder.
Well, let me ask the Chief Justice's question a little differently. At the end of the day, didn't Vice Chancellor Noble say there were no damages?
Absolutely, precisely, Your Honor.
So it's that simple.
That is absolutely a correct statement. That is absolutely what Vice Chancellor Noble found, and I would emphasize that that was a finding based not on simple reference to an antiseptic partnership agreement, but after hearing the testimony of witnesses, after hearing testimony from the only investor to present at trial, after looking at the transcripts of depositions taken of the other plaintiffs, and on, and experts and documents in this long-lived case, yes, that was a factual finding that is no damages, Your Honor.
Okay. Forget the no damages for a moment. I started out with the supposition, apparently wrong, that everyone agreed you needed to have 100% vote in order to amend the partnership agreement, and only by amending the partnership agreement could you change the distributions. You do not agree with that?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor. And
okay.
I have.
Okay, well, let me take it stepwise for me. So your position is that in the partnership agreement, the authority given to the general partner to negotiate and conclude a transaction such as this includes the authority to modify distributions.
That is one reason, Your Honor, as well as the fact that the strict terms of the partnership agreement, I don't believe, are as clear as the plaintiffs would like them to be as to the requirement for an amendment and in the circumstances in which case there would be an amendment. And we did present this as one of a number of reasons why it was not simply a matter of breach, that why the fact that distributions were substituted by interest wasn't a flat-out breach of the partnership agreement. There are, again, it has somehow become embedded in the case that to do what the general partner did would have required a 100% vote of the limited partners, and I don't believe that the partnership agreement is anywhere nearly that clear.
Did the Vice Chancellor agree with you on that issue and make a finding accordingly, or did he weasel word breach by saying there was a transgression?
I certainly don't know that it was a weasel word, Your Honor.
Well, what does it mean? As a matter of law, what does transgression mean? Maybe canon law or biblical law, I could understand. But how do you transgress a contract?
I would say that that means in some way failed to comply with the contract. Or breached the contract. I think that what Vice Chancellor Noble said is it doesn't matter.
No, I understand at the end of the day, but you're making the interesting argument and supporting it that the general partner had the right to construct the deal the way he did and in the process to eliminate, without 100% approval of limited partners, a right to a distribution until liquidation. But the Vice Chancellor never agreed with you on that, as I read the opinions. And the earlier opinions say, I really don't know what the limited partners believed the disclosure statement really meant to them, and won't know until after they tell me it after trial, which may have been a neat way for me not to have to make a decision in 1997. But in any event, that's what happened. Now, where does he agree with you that the general partner had the right to construct the sale the way the general partner did?
He does not agree with us. He does not directly address and rebut that argument. That was an argument
he
that
doesn't
we
agree or disagree.
He doesn't agree or disagree.
Okay. And you're saying that, and this goes back to the no damages, that whatever the right or the wrong of that debate may be, it was economically mooted. That is, the proponents of the transaction hedged their bets by making sure that the interest would be no less than the amount of the distributions that would otherwise be called for. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is it also a fair statement that there's nothing in the record that suggests that there's some tax consequence to the limited partners of taking interest at whatever it was, 5.25%, instead of distributions over a period of time, and that there's no time value of money involved over the period of time? They're not receiving distributions, but receiving straight interest in lieu of it? Is there any economic consequence besides the set off dollar to dollar? Is that in the record anywhere?
It's not in the record. The record simply presents the numbers, the math. There were different iterations of what the distributions could have, might have, should have been, and there was in fact a significant swing in the plaintiffs.
Okay, well, Mr. Cumber argues that there's a qualitative difference between calling it interest and calling it a distribution, and I understand that the Chief Justice's question goes to that, whether there's a tax consequence that wouldn't attach if it wasn't called interest. And you're saying we don't have an answer to that question?
I'm saying that was not addressed in the record at trial. It was not.
I couldn't find it. That's why.
There's no evidence one way or the other that it was a new.
Just for my sake, to be clear, would you be willing to state that it doesn't matter to you, to your client, whether the agreement was breached or not, because the result still is that there's no damages?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Your honorable opponent agrees that there would be no damage unless there was a legal entitlement of the partners to receive both the distribution and the interest. And there were a series of questions. There was a colloquy that took place when he was at the podium as to what the legal basis would be to receive both. What is your view on that?
My view is that it would be a windfall for the limited partners to receive both the interest that was a direct result of the approval of the sale transaction, as well as the distributions. The term windfall has been used before, not just before today. Vice Chancellor Noble queried whether it wouldn't be a windfall in one of the earlier arguments on this.
Because there is no basis.
There is no basis for it. But that underscores, Your Honor, the reason why this is not a case that can be determined de novo by simply reviewing the contract and interpreting the contract, and that is that there are a number of factual determinations that the Vice Chancellor had to make by reference to more than just the partnership agreement, but by reference to the testimony of the sole investor to take the stand, by reference to other documents, by the testimony of one of the defendants who was the manager of the general partnership, and that was to conclude that the reasonably prudent limited partner, upon receiving the disclosure statement and approving or disapproving the sale transaction, would have understood the consequence. And that is why this is a case that has always been one that has been reserved for trial and for factual determination, and not just a case, but an issue right. within a case.
But that runs headlong into the counterargument that, it may be nice for 58% of the shareholders to waive their otherwise contractual right. They can waive it for themselves, but they can't waive it for the other 42%.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they, as if there were two groups, one who voted yes to approve the deal after seeing the disclosure statement and those who voted no. Was there actually a 100% vote by the limited partners one way or the other?
No, I believe, Your Honor, that there were some 80% voted, and
that's what I recall. So it wasn't strictly a matter of some said yes and some said no.
Right.
Some remained silent, perhaps relying on their contractual rights.
And in this case, the one, Stanton Barnes, the one limited partner to take the stand at trial said that he understood the consequence, but he didn't think he voted. Another one of the limited partners who tested, and this is part of the record, who testified in deposition many years ago, voted to approve the transaction and then rescinded her vote. Another voted no.
Well, what was the key factual determination, apart from no damages, which I know you relied upon earlier? If a trial was necessary, what was the key factual determination that allows you to win?
The factual determination is that in the total mix of information presented to investors and after the review of all of the evidence, the trial court made a factual determination that a reasonably prudent limited partner would have understood that his or her vote to approve the sale transaction would be tantamount, and that is a word that the Vice Chancellor Steele used in the opinion that dates back to the year 2000, to the cessation or the termination of a right to distributions. The issue of what a reasonably prudent partner would have understood, which in turn, of course, requires factual determination beyond a review of the mere partnership agreement, has been articulated by a succession of courts, vice chancellors, hearing arguments on this issue dating back to 1997. It is, in fact, what Vice Chancellor Noble ended up determining, and that is that a reasonably prudent limited partner, first, the court can now conclude that the limited partners were fully informed that if they approved the sale transaction, quarterly distributions would cease as of the effective date, and that interest would be paid from the effective date till the consummation date. The issue of distributions has always, I say always, back to 1997 and specifically back to 2000, been recognized by the court and recognized by the parties, recognized by the plaintiff in pretrial submissions and in pretrial motions and in pretrial memoranda as one that would require a review of the facts. I think what probably happened, and I'm speculating, is that the plaintiffs assumed that they would get the right testimony from Mr. Barnes, and when Mr. Barnes testified candidly that he did know, he would have known, he did understand, then the theory that this is something that requires a reference to evidence changed to, no, this is just a case that can be determined to know.
Everything you're saying still brings us back to the damage issue, because even if a reasonably prudent limited partner would know that, the legal argument is you needed 100% of them to not only know it but agree. And you didn't have 100%. So if we say there was an 80% vote, the 20% people are basically saying, I got your disclosure, I didn't vote for it, you can give me the five, you can give me the interest, but you can't take away my distribution. And the only answer to that is that you're not entitled to vote, isn't it?
There is no equitable or contractual right for the limited partners to receive both, and it was certainly the Vice Chancellor's position and understanding is expressed in the opinion that it would not be equitable, and it didn't make sense for the limited partners to receive both the interest and the distributions, particularly in the context of a sale transaction, which made it clear to them, he found, made it clear to them that they were going to substitute one for the other. It was either or.
At the risk of paraphrasing Tina Turner, what does equity have to do with it? This is a contract. This is either a contractual right and a contract that was breached or not. Or it's a contract that was breached and the consequences result in no damages. But it has nothing to do with equity.
We're not just talking about one contract, Your Honor. We're talking about a series of contracts, and we're talking about relationships between a general partner, limited partners, and purchasing affiliates. And as an issue of disclosure, and this has been framed as a disclosure case as well as a contract case, Vice Chancellor Noble did address issues of equity, and I think that they are appropriately addressed. And given the disclosures that Vice Chancellor Noble found were clearly made and clearly understood by the limited partners understood that they were not entitled to both. which is where equity comes back into.
But the issue raised by your opponent is that 100% of them had to agree. It wasn't what they understood. You didn't have 100% vote.
If this court, in looking at the partnership agreement, agrees with my opponent and concludes that we don't need to look any further than the partnership agreement, which is not what the trial court did. The trial court, as did a succession of vice chancellors before Vice Chancellor Noble in hearing the case in trial, concludes that if this court concludes that you don't need to go beyond the partnership agreement, you still are confronted with a conclusion that I know that this court has been addressing this afternoon, that there was no injury, that there was no damage, that in fact there was a net benefit realized by the limited partners as a result of the transaction that was approved. So the other 20% that didn't vote were still realized a net benefit from the transaction. And the only way that the plaintiff can win on this, and I think that, Your Honor, you identified this, is to accept his theory, which is not supported by logic or law or evidence, and I won't even use the word equity, that you get both. And the reason you don't get both is you knew going into it you wouldn't get both. It was not structured as a deal that was going to penalize the general partner for doing it. And the bottom line is there is no evidence, and was no evidence, in fact there is contrary evidence, that the general partner and the purchasing affiliates entered into the deal understanding that there was going to be an exchange, not that there was going to be an addition. So you have to wind the entire transaction back to conclude that the limited partners should have gotten both. Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Counsel just went over 1 minute. Do you want 1 minute? Do you want to defease your waiver of the 8 seconds, or are you satisfied with the argument?
Your Honor, unless one of Your Honors has a question for me, I'm willing to rest on our argument.
I see no questions. Thank you very much. Counsel, thanks for an interesting argument. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Here you go.